My name is Wayne Dammert, and I'm 80 years old now. When I got in the Navy in 1957, it was kind of tough getting a job right then. I'd done nice in the Navy. It really helped me to grow up. I worked on airplanes, electrical systems. But when I got out, it was hard getting a job. So I played golf at Summit Hills. My dad had been a member there. And you know how at playing golf, you meet up with groups. So this day I filled in, I played with three guys, and one of them was the big boss at the Beverly Hills, who happened to live near me in South Hills, off Kyle's Lane. So halfway through our match, I said, "Mr. Todd, I wonder if I could get a job up there. You know, I'm the busboy, whatever. I don't know." He said, "Yeah," he says, "be up there tonight and see Mr. Goodhart." So I wore a sport coat, and Mr. Goodhart was in charge of the gambling casino. Later on, he became in charge of the Desert Inn. Oh, boy. So I started, he put me on a dice table. For 3 days, I was watching and learning, right? And right next to me, standing, was Jerry Lewis. Right off the bat, Jerry Lewis, and he dropped about a quick $700. Now, this was before the show was over or anything, and really nothing happened much till after the show. So he left. Well, for 3 days, I watched and listened and everything, and on the fourth day, I'm dealing cards. I'm dealing the Stan Musial. There was a show, The Greatest Show on Earth, the movie, and this beautiful girl, I can't remember her name, but she was in there. I'm dealing cards to her. I'm dealing cards to the late night show guy. Whatever. It was really neat.
So this was in 1957. It was, it was the showplace of the area, and all the celebrities would come there, but there was also gambling there, unlike the later version of the
club. Correct. And the gambling, it was illegal. And the bingo money all went for the payoff stuff, whatever. I would see rabbis, and I would see all kind of people up there, whatever. And I'm not saying that in the wrong way, but that's just how it was back then. And there were two times when I was there when the bell rang, and it wasn't a casino anymore. People were drinking coffee and everything because it wasn't the bathrooms and everything. And one night, some ladies were in the bathroom. It's all right. They had to put all their equipment in the bathroom.
But in the 50s, it was people, you mentioned Jerry Lewis, but Stan Musial, Dean Martin, Milton Berle.
Yeah, they were there. I had a lot of their autographs on a baseball. They were there, if not for one thing, for another, but some for the show, some just be there. Yeah, it was great.
And then in 1961, it closed down.
Yes, it did. And I think I was just about the only one in Northern Kentucky. They all closed about that same time. And they all went to Las Vegas. And my wife didn't want to go that far out west because she's from New York, New Jersey. So I didn't go. I got into industry. The ones that didn't work at Beverly all worked at a couple of the bigger places downtown. I think the Showboat and a few of those.
There were still other clubs like the Lookout House in Northern Kentucky in this interim before, what, 1970 or 1971?
Well, most of it closed in 61.
This is when George Radiman was running for sheriff, and he was the cleanup guy, right?
Yeah, that was about that time. What happened, though, I believe there may be some what we'd call some bust-out joints that still went on. What happened with these places, and it was plain and simple, if the gang knew that they were making a profit, they would come in and say, you know, we know you're for sale. No, we're not for sale. Yeah, you are for sale. You're the manager. You're making a nice pay. They just wanted your place, okay? So if you didn't, you're going to be sorry. You're going to be burned down or what. So what happened was is the group from Cleveland, they didn't know about Beverly Hills. It was going. It was going around 35, 36, whatever. Okay, it was going. But they didn't know that. There was something going on at Coney Island with a racetrack or some gambling or what there. They knew that. Well, somebody one day told them, don't you know about the Beverly Hills? No, no, no. So they went up there, and they tried to buy it from Glenn and Pete Smith. They wouldn't sell it to them, like I told you. So one night it burned down in the mid-30s, okay? And a little girl from Alexandria was in the fire. She got killed because it was at night and they were closed and she was staying with her grandparents. So it burned down. Well, Pete Smith rebuilt it. He wasn't going to sell. He wasn't going to let them get, well, the guys sent people in there to take a leak on the floor, to defecate on the floor. Well, so he sold it to them. And then later is when I went to work there.
So it was empty till about 1970 when Richard Schilling told you he was going to buy it and remodel it and reopen it as the modern show place that we knew it as in the 70s?
Yes, he did. It was absolutely beautiful. Mr. Schilling would go all over looking at things, construction sites, other buildings, other everything to get the best. Chandeliers, they were tremendous. The walls were actually painted mural with The rows are sticking out like a quarter of an inch, and they were just beautiful in there, everything the best. And he kept adding on, and he finally put the big showroom on there. But what happened right off the beginning was he wasn't using the certain labor he should have been using. So somehow in 1971, it burned down. He didn't do anything for a week or two. He said, no, he's what the heck, no, I'm going to go on with this. So he did, and it opened in 72. I worked in industry. I'd become a draftsman, and we made tanks for distilleries and chemical plants and a whole lot of work, like in Procter & Gamble. And I did the drawings, and I would go to all these places and see what they needed and bought the material. So I did that. But also, I went to work for them as a waiter, and then before long, they made me a banquet captain in a tuxedo. So
So you were working part-time. Did you still keep the draftsman job and then part-time in the evening?
Right. And they were really getting busy, very busy. By the way, when I did work at the Beverly Hills earlier, I would go on stage every night after the show and call the bingo. So that was pretty neat. Liberace, when he was finished, I'd go on the stage. And Tony Bennett, I even played golf with him. But when I was working for the Shillings, they were nice to me. Rick was a really nice guy. One night, Rick says, go down to a certain place, friend of mine, and get a tuxedo. So I became a banquet captain. We were getting busier and busier and busier.
And then the club grew and grew, too, did it not, in the early 70s?
Yes, they had a small showroom, and they took that out. And I remember one night when they took it out, I had a friend there. I took her up to see Milton Berle. He was the show. And he came around where I was sitting. He said, oh, a freebie, I see. He was teasing me. I see you're in here for free. But anyway, they built a new show room to hold about 700-800. And I know they only had a little over at the total of 1,000 chairs at the most. That's all they had. And some people said, oh, there were 1,200 people in the room. Well, they didn't have that many chairs for that. And it became completely beautiful. It wasn't expensive at all. You got a meal and everything. To show you, one week, Frankie Valli was there. I think it was Saturday. His first show was on, and the line started forming by the entrance to the showroom and going back this long hall, 150 feet or whatever it was, and then that went up into a left turn up into the bar. Well, I looked, whoa, it's getting long. So it got into the bar, and these people were packed in the bar. I said, whoa, wait a minute. So I started a line back down toward the front door, down the steps, and I got to the front door. I said, whoa, nobody else is going in here. And they lined about 50 feet maybe down the driveway. And I feel bad still. It's on my mind. About one guy, his wife tagged him, like, give him something. You know, so he gave me a few bucks, whatever it was, you know. So I just let him inside the door. I could have taken him right into the showroom. I wasn't thinking.
For people who weren't here at the time, the club sat on a hill,
yes,
and it's where 27,
yes,
outside of Newport,
right,
at 471. So
right,
if you're going near that interchange on the south side,
south side.
On a big,
yes,
tall hill, that's, yeah, where the club sat up,
yes,
on the top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in part a two-story club, correct?
Part of it was two-story, and part of it was just one, and like where the showroom had a really high ceiling.
So as you came in the front door, the showroom was kind of in the back right corner, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes,
and as
it
you
was.
Came into the lobby area, there was this grand staircase that went upstairs.
Yeah, beautiful.
And then there was banquet rooms. So that's where it was two-story, kind of right,
that's
above
the
entrance.
That's where it was. Very old casino, way back, had been up there. Well, then the other casino, when I worked there, was then where the Viennese rooms were.
And the rooms upstairs were called what again?
They were called crystal rooms. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 3 on one side, 3 on the other for bigger parties.
I had been there in the late 70s to see Lou Rawls. And as I recall, when we came in there, we ate in one of the rooms,
yes,
somewhere else in the complex.
Yes.
And then after the meal, we went down the hall to the big cabaret showroom. Oh. So that's how, on a big night like Memorial Day weekend, when John Davidson was going to be there, you had the 1,000 people, however, that were in the showroom. Mm-hmm. Did they eat somewhere else before and then go to that?
Yes.
And in addition to that, you had, in the small banquet rooms, you had different groups meeting. There was a retirement group, and you were working in what room,
well,
serving what groups?
I actually would be all over the place, you know, being a banquet captain. At that time, I was the only banquet captain. Of course, the Shillings would do the same thing. I happened to be upstairs then because I had one party of a black group, was the Cincinnati Choral Group, 120 people, and they had a 7-piece orchestra. And on the other side I had 90 people with the Afghan Hound Club, and there were people there from all over America. They had trophies and everything. So we had well over 200 people upstairs.
And those rooms were which ones?
That was the Crystal Rooms.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the Baptist Choral Group, there was also performers as part of that in the band?
The choral group, as far as I know and remember, they had like a 7-piece orchestra with them. I didn't see them because when I went in, got to that room and the fire, the waitresses got those people out already. But it was really crowded up there. And then throughout the thing, in the back were all these beautiful glassed-in ceiling and all, and all the chandeliers and all. Those were the garden rooms. And there were then 5 of them. They kept adding and adding and adding, and they were all full.
Was that kind of to the back end of the building and kind of off the edge of the back end of the cabaret room then?
Yeah, back in the cabaret rooms. We called them the garden rooms.
And this is how the club had expanded. Almost every year they'd add another room because it was so hugely popular.
It was popular. It wasn't expensive, and it was beautiful. So how could you miss? And you got lobster steak at good prices, and the atmosphere was great.
So tell me about that night, Memorial Day weekend, 1977. You report to work, what, about 6 o'clock?
I got around 6. I got there, yeah.
And you know it's going to be a busy night.
Yeah, we knew it was going to be busy. Really, a lot of activity. And the show, John Davis and always drew well. And it's funny because the night before there, Friday night, we were busy, and I took some friends of mine in the back part of the show so they could see some of it. And you go down the hallway, and that's where the dressing room, backstage, and everything is that way. And when I was coming back out, John Davis was in the hall, and he was going to go. I said, John, where are you going? He says, I'm going to take this tape out to my man that's in the audience, in the back of the audience, you know, the booth.
The sound booth.
John, you can't go out there. I said, there's a big, long line of people waiting to get in there. So he instructed me what to do. When I got all done, he said, now you tell me exactly what I just told you. So I did that. That was the night before.
So you delivered the tape to the sound booth so he could record that
evening
show.
Whatever he wanted for that night, yeah.
One more point about the layout of the club, because they'd add this piece the next year and another piece. Yeah. So it wasn't like there were straight hallways going up and down inside. It was kind of circuitous to get to some of the different rooms?
It was, but there weren't any actual circles. They were 90-degree turns to go where you had to go.
It wasn't laid out on a straight grid of straight lines this way way.
It wasn't, but that's how the hallways turned out. It was a conglomeration of a lot of different things that they kept doing. He just kept adding. Why wouldn't you when you were so busy? And they still didn't have enough.
So you get to work about 6 o'clock, and then closer to 9 o'clock, what do you recall?
Okay. We're busy. We're doing all our things. We got the people served over in the choral group side and everything. I would take the checks to the different rooms, the different party rooms. I had to get the check and take it, go out in the front office, look what it was, and make up the bill. Well, I was hustling to get my party. We were running late. A lot of these things always run late, and I was trying my best. And in the meantime, I had to take that bill down to the Zebra Room. And it used to be a closet, and they were so busy, they made it into a little party room. And that used to be our dealer's break room when I was dealing cards.
And that was on the first floor?
Up under the bar at the Crystal Room, basically. And,
okay.
And under the dressing rooms that were up there on the Crystal Rooms. I had 27 people using those dressing rooms that night from the choral group party. So I took Shirley Wagner. She's the girl that was in the room, and she's cutting the cake over on the right side of the room as you go in. And I stood for a couple minutes under the light sconce above me. Stood there for a couple minutes. I'm looking at my watch. I was teasing the people, you want the bill? No, I don't want to give it to him, you know, whatever. About 5 minutes later, Shirley was finished, and I gave her the bill. We got that straight. And that was about 25 till 9. Well, I went upstairs to my party, and we're missing a salad bowl on our buffet for the Afghan Hound group. So I went back down to the kitchen. Where's the salad? You know what? It's in that big walk-in cooler. So I went in, and I found it. It's a great big silver bowl full of salad. So I'm taking it up the narrow stairs that go up to the back to the upstairs.
This was a service stairs.
Service stairs, and alongside that was a service elevator. I didn't use that too much. So when I got up there, I went through this hallway up there. It was a little hallway in the back, just a maintenance kind of a hallway.
And this was between 8:30 and 9-ish?
This was getting almost to 9, close to 9 by that time. So I went in and opened the back doors to the Crystal Rooms, and Fran Oakes was standing there. I says, Wayne, there's a fire down in the zebra room. I'm thinking, wait, it's just there. And I looked, and I saw some smoke coming up. There's no question, coming up that long hallway that's upstairs.
This was at the far end of the second floor from the service elevator, at the very opposite end.
If you went into the club, the crystal rooms were all upstairs, above the left, then the old casino, way back.
So you saw some smoke coming from under the door?
Coming around the hallway, around the L of the hallway up there. So I put that sound down fast, and I said, out the back, everybody out the back, as loud as I could, get out the back. And boy, they all turned, and they didn't see any smoke because it wasn't in there yet, but they knew something was wrong. So they turned, and they all went back, and then I went through them down to the other end to make sure everybody's out. And when I got there, there was a black man from the party across the hall, and I said, get out of here, man. And he was holding a coat that he was modeling or something. And he turned around, and he could see through the doors there. There were three sets of doors along that way. And one of them was where the fire was coming up. He saw, and he turned, and he flew out. His eyes got like great big marbles, and he flew out of there. And I don't blame him. So everybody's out of that side. So I know I got people using, the 27 people had been using the dressing rooms on the other side. So I went back to the back near where the door was, and it was all clear out by then. And I went down the other side, and there were like 12 10-top tables in there, and that made it room crowded. And I got through there, and I got to the doors at the far end. I was going to see if I could get over there and help anybody that might be in there. And I eased the doors open about 4 inches maybe wide, and it was unbelievable. It was so hot that you couldn't believe it. There's nothing I could do there. So I think, well, I'm out of here. I can get out of here. So I went back there, and I got in that back hallway, which is an L, just a little service hallway. Wasn't nothing to it. And in that hallway was a plywood door, just because it was for maintenance and stuff, that went out onto a flat roof. It was a nice, cool, pretty night outside. Well, I get in there, nobody's moving. It's jammed. All well-dressed people, too. It's jammed. Whoa, whoa. And I yelled to a couple of these big guys, I said, knock that door down, because I know. And Miss Schilling later asked me, why'd you say to do that? I wanted to get out of there.
So this was a plywood door that would have gotten out to roof, kind of almost to the side of the canopy over the front.
Yeah. And it wasn't plywood to be cheap or anything. There was work being done all the time, and that's what that was used for. But it did have a padlock thing on it. They tried twice, and it didn't break, and the lights went out. Oh, man, I'm at the end of the line, and one of the girls said later, you should see the look on your face when the lights came back on. She said she was behind me even. So the lights went back out. Well, there. All of a sudden, pitch black. I know this thing is roaring toward us. There's no question about it. And I saw a complete color picture of my family in front of me. That was the good Lord telling me, you need to get out of here. So I worked over to the wall where the doorway and where the stairs and the elevator were. Unfortunately, nobody could get on that elevator because it was locked. I worked my way over, we can get out of here. Well, when I got to the stairs, people started moving, but I didn't trust that. I got down there, went through the kitchen. The kitchen was well lit, and the kitchen help was on the tables trying to direct people, but there wasn't hardly anybody left at that time. We were just about
so
last.
So the kitchen people knew that there was, there was a fire.
Yeah, because all the people from upstairs and also from the big showroom, the old Empire Room, we'll come through there. Well, I looked and the Empire Room was empty. So I think I got to get and see if those people got out. So I went out the back little service platform. I ran around to the front. There was a couple fire trucks there already. And I asked the one guy, I said, I need help. He said, no. He said, the chief's got us going around the back. I don't know what's happening in the back. I know what's where I was. And he said, try the next one. Well, there's another one there. And I helped a fireman get an axe. We grabbed an axe and a ladder. And I said, why do you have people trapped upstairs? So we put that just after the veranda on the front of the building, went under that, and just to the left side of that, we put the ladder up. And I went up first, and I helped him climb over because it was like a 2 foot higher than the roof was. So and I went over, and then there was another one of those little climb over things. And I pulled him over that. He's got all the equipment on everything. We got to that door. He put his axe in there, and that thing just come right open because one more hit was open. And this thick black wall of smoke just came out on us. Scott Schilling was with us there, too. Well, Scott and I went back down. There's nothing we could do. And he stayed there, this guy. fighting it. And I saw a picture of him later on, of his face over the top of the roof there. He looked forlorn. So then I went onto the veranda, and there was a beautiful young lady, probably maybe about 30 years old, laying on the ground there. Her husband, her boyfriend, her husband, I guess, is with her, and she has a heart problem. She probably might have been dead now. But anyway, the first life squad then just pulled up. So several of us picked her up and carried her over, and we had to go over that beautiful chain-like thing that went up there at that time and put her in the life squad. And they says, "That's all we have room for. We got to go." I says, "No, you're not going anywhere. To see if anybody else here. I don't know." And that's when they bought Paul Smith. And I figured out years later he was a violinist in the show because he had his tux on and his show stuff. So they slid him in the floor. Then there was no way for him to turn around or anything. I put my hand on his door handle, and I says, "I'm telling police, fireman, ever get out of the way, because we're backing this thing down." And another life squad squeezed past us going up. And when I came back up, I did the same thing to him. I walked two of them down. So I see a little busboy after the second one. I says, Mark Johnson. "Oh," he said, "it's terrible back there. It's just awful."
You mean in the back of the building?
Yeah, in the
where
back,
you hadn't been.
Right, I hadn't been back there, right.
At that point, when you were there backing emergency vehicles up and down the driveway, could you see flames coming out the top at that point, like later we saw on TV?
To be honest with you, there I didn't. So I thought, I've got to get back there. Who am I? But I still got to get back there. So I went along the front of the building, and it was very narrow, and in front of that was a very steep, rugged hillside.
That was okay. A drop down to 27.
Drop down, yeah, it was full of trees and stuff, but right. Yeah, it was a pretty steep drop. Well, when I got to the showroom right door, right side exit door from the stage, there were a lot of confusion, and there were some bodies laying there, and I heard them say, "Oxygen, oxygen." I went on back, and I got to the back, the corner of the building where the garden and all started, was a gigantic garden, and I'm hearing, "Oxygen, oxygen, we need oxygen." So I went there. The mayor of my city, Alexandria, was there, Pat Fanning. I said, "Pat, they need oxygen back there." And he took care of it because he was in the middle of stuff. He knew. So they got that. Well, as soon as I got around the back corner, right where the left showroom exit door was, and on that door you had to go out double doors where the waitresses came in and out, and you had to go left. It was in the bar, and you had to go 20 feet to get out the building. And so this lady was laying right outside that door, an older lady, once again, a pretty blue dress like the other lady was. And she's dead on a doornail. You can see that. But her husband, a beautiful white outfit and all really nice, is sitting there. He's in shock. And I said, "Sir, let me see if I can breathe into her mouth and help." And just as I got down and started to do that, my doctor, Dr. Braun, happened to be there because that night, one surgeon had a bunch of doctors there, like they do for a meeting and a dinner. Fortunately, they were there, and they set up a triage. The doctor came up behind me. "Oh, Wayne, he knew me." He says, "She's dead." Well, what I did, I took the man's light blue coat, and I took his jacket from him, and I laid it over her face, covered her up, and put my arm around this guy, and a nice-looking fella. And I said, "Now, your wife's with God now." You know, I said, "You be brave." And when I did that, I felt something drop on my legs. I was kneeling. And what the heck? And I turned around, there's a lady's body brought out and dropped, and they said, "Get her out of here." Okay, so another guy and I picked this lady up, and she starts moaning. Whoa. So we ran. We didn't know triage was there, but we ran that way, and we saw him. And we started to put her down, and this doctor said, right away, he said, "She's dead." Well, I'll tell you why that is. "She's dead. Get her out of here." Okay, so this time I took her by myself back. There's bodies laying all over back there.
So it was kind of on a hillside? Just flat?
It's pretty far back to where the hillside was. It was a big garden area. Even on the other side of that garden, there was a rock wall at the back of the garden. It was even flat back in there.
So they're literally just laying in rows?
They were laying in rows. And man. So I saw a waitress, and I said, "Are you religious?" And she said, "Yes, I am." I said, "Would you pray over these bodies over here, and I'll pray over these bodies." So I would kneel down and put my head. Fortunately, all the heads were covered. Put my hand on her head, and I just, "God, would you please take this soul into heaven?" You know, okay. So I found out later, Chef Chandler told me a couple years later, he says, "You know, I was doing all right till I saw you praying over those bodies." He said, "Then I lost it." But anyway, after I did that, probably to maybe 50, it's hard to say, maybe 50 bodies, there's 165 killed. My priest came up there. Now, he was the fire chief's brother. Father Reisenberg. So I went with him. I told him what I did. And then I went with him while he blessed the bodies again. And then I yelled, "Are there any bodies up there? Any bodies up?" "Yeah, there's one up here." So I went up, and a whole lot of employees were around a big tablecloth laying there and a body under it. And they said, "Wayne, you know Terry Rose?" And I said, "Yeah." I says, "Well, that's her there."
She was a co-worker?
A cocktail waitress, yeah. Now, her and the most beautiful girl you ever want to see was Rose Dishar. And her daughter is my good friend right now. And she, you know, got burned to a crisp. I shouldn't say that. But the only way, and her daughter will even tell you, she was really onto her teeth. They were beautiful, right? But she went to a whole lot of dentists for this. And finally, about 4 days later, they figured out who she was. Now, there was other confusion. One lady was there in her purse beside her. She was a Peace Corps worker, and they buried her. That wasn't her. It was somebody else, so they had to dig that up. Another lady from Lexington, Kentucky, was burned really bad, but her one leg was under a table. It didn't get burned, and she had a high-heel shoe on there. They knew this lady who was missing was from Lexington, so they went to Lexington. They went to her house. They went to her closet. There's the box for the shoe. Yeah. And another poor lady, I can't think of her name right now, but they lost a lot of their family. And the one girl, Barbara, I think Barbara, she didn't die till about 5 or 6 months later. It was just a mess.
Eventually, those bodies that were laying there on the hillside, they were taken to the Fort Thomas Armory, right? And that kind of became the makeshift morgue?
Right. They had a fleet of Army trucks up there, and they had a lot of, even young kids were volunteering. And they got all those bodies out before the next day, Sunday, it would have been Sunday. Took them to the morgue, and that's where all the people had to go identify them. And that wasn't an easy chore either. That was, you can imagine all those bodies going up there.
I've seen the pictures that the Enquirer had, because I was on the staff back then, and it was just kind of like this big gymnasium-like building with just rows and rows of the deceased
yes.
laying there. They needed to take them someplace, and that's where they put them.
That's where they put them. And like I say, they were in rows up there in the armory, covered. They would take the people and the thing back to see. There was one fireman. His name was Robert Zadak from Cincinnati, and he got killed doing his duty. And his brother saw his body up in the morgue, and he said it was blue, and there was some blood running out of his mouth. We know what killed them. I didn't know at that time, but we know it was in that room, which is beautiful.
The cabaret room.
Cabaret room.
Let's just talk about the cabaret room.
In there were beautiful partitions, about maybe 3-4 foot high. And on the top of them was a beautiful maroon vinyl, curved. Well, they were curved because underneath there was foam, polyvinyl chloride foam. When that heats, one breath, and you're gone. You're dead. That's what killed the people, not the fire. Toxic smoke, and that's why those doctors outside knew these people were dead. They had one breath, and that's my friend, Paul Smith. He got out, and my friend, Mr. Cianciola, saw him. He said, "I'm okay, Fred. You okay?" "Yes." Well, he had the breath, and he died dead right there.
Tell me about the cabaret room and kind of describe it. It was multi-tiered?
Yes, it was
and bars on either end?
Yes, it was. And once again, John, that was another room where they built it and then they added on to it after the first room was too small. But yes, it was beautiful maroon, really nice in there. Beautiful showroom with partitions all around and the little railings over the partitions and back areas where they added on up in the back corners. And everything was beautiful except the exits. Now, here's what happened.
So were there just two? Is that right?
There were basically two exits and the one you came in.
So the main doors, and then there was two fire exits or two exits.
Two exits.
For 1,000 people.
And none of them went directly outside.
And they were both kind of in within the corners, so to either side of the stage?
Right and left corners of the stage. And there was a bathroom, a restroom, with a little aisle walkway to it on the left side of the stage. And I think some people might have gone in there. But when you went out the right exit of the showroom in the front, you know, stage right, you went into a hall. Then you had to turn right. And then you went, and then there was the exit. It wasn't a straight-out thing. And somebody somehow blocked that, and they said it was done on purpose for a while, but it wasn't. It just happened. And then you went on the left. You went through the bar right alongside where the bar was, and the dish, all the trays with the glasses and everything. And then you turned left, and you went about 20 feet, then you were out in the garden. The front, where you went in, there was two sets of, like, doors, in pretty much the same spot. One had a curtain over it, one might have a door. Just to the right of that was about 20, 30 more feet, another exit, but not just for that room, for other things. That wasn't enough. And also, in the old Viennese room, which has been the casino when I worked there, there was a set of doors, but I saw the picture later where everything had burned out. Well, there was a double chain with a lock on it laying at the bottom where the middle of the door was. They were locked. They were chain locked. But they didn't really need those, but the rest of them, yeah.
And I think the studies afterwards, investigation, that there was just one of the reasons was the contents of the room and the cause of the toxic smoke. Another reason was with only two exits and 1,000 people needing to get out, and because it was a convoluted, twisty-turny thing that people
showroom.
Just...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Those people in there just really just didn't have a chance to survive, to get out.
Right, yeah. You mentioned curvature at the beginning. It was like an oval, straight in the middle and then rounded.
Right.
And so there's a lot of rounding in there. Yes, most of it was not straight out. You had to go along an area and then up.
And if you went out one of those exits, were there also hallways to dressing rooms or bathrooms that you could have turned the wrong way instead of getting outside?
Absolutely. The seven members of the band, I think it was seven, that died on that exit there. Well, right by that exit, there was a closet door, and they had their stuff in there, and they went in to get it instead of going out. But these were not straight-out exits. No, not at all.
And it would have been dark. Yeah, and smoky. And when they came out, I would imagine, if my recollection is correct on reading reports, that as people tried to get out, then there were like stacks of bodies that then eventually blocked the exit so that, again, because they had inhaled the smoke, so the exits got blocked that way by the sheer numbers.
Yes, fireman Bruce Rath, who died not too long ago, he was a real hero. He had, if I'm not mistaken, his fire helmet said like 912 or whatever, a famous number. And the next day, if I understand, his picture was even in Japan. But what happened with him, he was with those stacked people trying to get him out. And at one time, carrying one of them, they pulled his mask off, but he got out. But he had another lady from Dayton, Ohio, that there's pictures in the paper with him, is holding her neck, and he's sitting in the back of the building. And she's dead. And the coroner, no, she's dead. No, she's not dead. And he took her, carried her to the life squad in the front seat, and she lived. She was married to, I think, a policeman up in Dayton, but she lived. He completely saved her life. You know, she got out all right.
I know you weren't there in the cabaret room that night, but you've written a book, you've documented well. So at some point when the fire was discovered, there were two comics on stage.
Yes, they were.
Teeter and McDonald.
Right.
And a busboy named Walter Bailey, who's just like a teenager.
Yes.
He was either told or he went up. How did that happen?
Well, Walter, he was something else. He had lived all over the country because his dad, I guess, was in the Army. And Walter was Walter. That's all I can tell you. But he's the least one you'd ever think could do that.
Just because he was kind of laid back?
He was an 18-year-old kid. Usually my busboy. He saw what was happening at the room, and he knew something was bad going on. What happened there at the room, Dave Brock and a couple other ones, we know the fire's in that room roaring. And the doors, the double doors are closed. This is in the zebra room where the fire broke out. Dave's there, and he knows it's bad in that room. So here come another busboy, Buddy Bethel, who's a good kid, coming down to his mother, and he had a lot of his family working there, too. Walter's a good boy. He come down the spiral staircase, I guess, before it broke out there, and Brock says, "No, Buddy, no." He knew what Buddy was going to do. He was going to jump over the railing right by the doors and open the doors. No! He didn't get in time. He opened it. Brock said the flames came out and they got out of the way, but all across the hall from that bottom of that spiral staircase was mirrors. Dave said immediately that you could see them like a wave. The heat was so bad, it was like a wave. Well, Walter, maybe right before that, went by there. So he looked in the Viennese rooms where the group of doctors were having their meeting, and he looked in another room because they could break into several, and he told the busboys and waiters, "Get your people out, get them out, go out the back. So he goes on back to the showroom, this little 18-year-old boy. Pauline, she's in charge of that room, you know, and you already even talked to Pauline. But he says, "Pauline, there's a fire in the front, and you need to," I didn't know it, but he said, "You need to unlock the doors because they didn't like people sneaking in.
So they locked
the exit doors room. Were locked. But so she did. Thank God. She did. So Walter, he's standing there. What should I do? He says, there's 1,000 people in this room. The comedian's on the stage. If I go up there and nothing happens, I'm fired. If I don't. So he went. Right when he's going on the stage, the comedian says, oh, there's an Indian. Well, here come Walter. People thought maybe that's the Indian. They didn't even think. Here, gave him the mic. They knew. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we have a small fire out in the front, so we're going to need to exit calmly. And he said, the people on this side, go out here, and the ones in your back, as you can, go out the back. But when you go out, do not turn left. So the most of the people listened, pretty much all, but then we know what happened. Now, I and other people that know that he saved at least 700 to 800 people. There's no question. And if he hadn't done that immediately, we'd be talking about 1,000 dead people. And there's no ifs, ands, and buts about it.
And many of the orchestra members, both the comics, Teeter McDonald and John Davidson, made it out. His music director,
Doug Hara,
didn't make it went back in to get
the
charts.
Yes, he went to get music, yes. You can't do it. There's a fire, everybody. You get out of there. It's like Nick Clooney said, if you go into a place, this is a quote from Nick, if you go into a place and you look around, you don't see exits, you don't see the fire, turn around and get yourself out of there. And if anybody asks you why, you say, I got 165 good reasons why. Not only 165, but over 200 injured badly.
Let me just ask you that directly. Since then, when you go to a restaurant, you go to a show, you go anywhere with your wife or anything, and it looks crowded, do you feel uncomfortable? Do you start looking at exits?
No, I'm sorry, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I should.
Okay.
I just go, and I feel, that it should be. And I got a lot of calls. I got a whole lot of calls after the fire in Rhode Island from all the newspapers, and they asked me questions. I was on one of the channels here for quite a while after that. Why? After the Venezuela, I think it was. And what I said there was after the Beverly Hills fire, and the communications around the world are all really sharp. Why, like down there, they had no exits. Why wouldn't they know these things by now? So, and a lot of firewalls came out of that fire, and one of the main ones was that firewall staircase can't be opened anymore. And occupancy signs have to be, a lot of things.
You went back to the fire scene 2 or 3 days later, 3 or 4 days later. Was that with the state or federal investigators?
Both. The day after, a federal guy was there. I don't know how he got there so fast. Here's the story. I was standing right exactly under where that fire started, just a few minutes actually before that, maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
So you were down when you were doing the bill.
Yeah, that was in the zebra room, right. And there was a light sconce right inside the room and about 7, 8 feet maybe, the most up above the head where I was standing, and that's where the fire burst out.
Okay.
Not in the room. It came from down the basement.
Okay.
So then they called me the next day, come down, and people were interviewing me, and I think there was a guy from Washington already there, and he said, would you walk me around? First off, I walked him up the stairs I got down, and when you got to the top, there wasn't anything there.
It had all been destroyed by the fire
and filter.
The
second floor was gone, except for one little tiny small part, but all the rest was gone. So we walk around the back and we walk out in the front, and the building had a false front on it to make it look real nice. And just after you got under the veranda, there was a little opening in the bottom of that I had never noticed before, but I saw it enough for you to get through it. And I said, well, the fire started right on the other side of that wall. Well, he takes off. Whoa. He climbs through there, and what it is, there's 2x4s holding that false, and he goes up there, and there's the broken out window that was in the room. Burned, broke out wide open in there, but it's behind that false front. So he goes in, and I go in, and the second floor and the roof are all in a V into the middle, into the floor in the middle of that. And I look behind that, and there's a tray stand full of dishes, not even touched. I saw later, right there where the fire started, I was right there at that same spot, the first one after it. Now, how you think you'd feel if you were standing right at the spot where this thing broke out and 165 people got killed? It's not easy. I'm okay with it. I just wish it would have never happened.
So you were there with the federal investigator.
Yes, I was.
Did you go back a couple of days later
State, yes, I did. And that's when I told a state policeman 4 days later that I said I had a lot of people using the dressing room upstairs, and I pointed, we could walk around. I almost see that part. Well, on the way home on the radio, I heard a bullet, and they just found two ladies' bodies that had been in an upstairs dressing room. Oh, my gosh.
But didn't one time shortly after the fire, shortly meaning within the week or two, that you went back there and that area where you were, that in the efforts to either find bodies or clear the site, that they...
Cleared it out pretty fast,
even though had it stayed there, they could have maybe found something.
That's true. They cleaned it out pretty fast, and they kept it pretty quiet as far as what we know.